Support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm your host, Kate Young.
We've identified that there is a dominant narrative around hunger specifically, and that often it can perpetuate the very conditions of poverty and hunger.
For today's show, we give a second listen to a conversation about what it means to challenge the dominant narratives around hunger in the U.S. and why some emergency food providers are looking at root causes of food insecurity as they face growing numbers of people seeking food assistance. Chef Daniel Orr shares a tangy, springy recipe featuring French sorrel, and Harvest Public Media brings us part two of their story on farmland loss in the Midwest. That's all just ahead on Earth Eats. We've got Alex Chambers here today. What's in the news this week?
Well, Kate, I've got an update on the lead situation in East Chicago, which affects soil and drinking water, and more on the trade dispute with China.
Okay, let's have it.
Spring has arrived, but for people living in parts of East Chicago, Indiana, gardening may not be possible for another 3 years. That's how long the EPA said it could take to dig up all the yards contaminated with lead and arsenic in the Calumet and East Calumet neighborhoods. Representatives from the Environmental Protection Agency held a meeting at the beginning of April to update residents on the cleanup efforts. The lead contamination became national news in 2016, when East Chicago's Mayor Anthony Copeland sent a letter to the residents of the West Calumet housing complex. It said the ground there was so contaminated, they needed to move as soon as possible. Soon afterward, workers were spreading mulch over bare spots in yards, and signs had sprung up warning children not to play in the dirt or around the mulch. But federal agencies had known about the contamination in the neighborhood, whose residents are mostly Black and Latino, for decades. The state first found lead in 1985, and in 2009, the EPA listed the site as one of the most contaminated in the country. Then, in 2017, as the EPA started to excavate soil, federal investigators tested the drinking water. They wanted to make sure the excavation process wasn't damaging the lead pipes that provided the city's water. What they found was that some households had dangerously high levels of lead in their household taps. At the meeting last week, Albert Kelly, a senior advisor to embattled EPA head Scott Pruitt, said the East Chicago cleanup is one of the agency's top priorities. EPA Region 5 Administrator Kathy Stepp said the team working on the Superfund site is doing its best to remedy the situation and get information to residents. The Trump administration is getting pushback over the growing trade dispute with China. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach has more from an event with farmers, a U.S. Department of Agriculture official, and a U.S. senator.
The latest round of tariffs threatened by China would affect American soybean farmers and cattle producers. At a roundtable in Omaha, U.S. Senator Ben Sasse says farmers are paying for the Trump administration's hardline tactics.
I don't know exactly what the administration's strategy is, but the brinksmanship language they're using sort of misunderstands how trade works.
USDA Undersecretary for Trade Ted McKinney told farmers at the event to be patient. But Bart Ruth is frustrated. He farms corn and soybeans in eastern Nebraska and says the current trade dispute is undermining decades of work building exports to China.
This administration seems prone to whatever the spur of the moment thoughts are that pop into the president's head, and I'm not sure that that message is finally reaching the top like it should.
Farm Bureau President Zippy Duval has called on the administration to negotiate with China before rounds of tariffs damage the farm economy. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Thanks to Harvest Public Media for that story.
As Harvest Public Media reported last week, population growth on the edges of cities has implications for farming. This week, Amy Mayer and Erica Hunsinger look at how communities near Des Moines and Kansas City are adapting. We start with Amy in Iowa.
The historic courthouse in Adel, Iowa, 30 minutes west of Des Moines, chimes the hour from a building bursting at its seams. Renovations just a decade ago added two new courtrooms, But Dallas County Clerk Anna Butler says already, again, there's just not enough space.
Now that's become an issue. It's becoming more frequently over the last few months where we've ran out of courtroom space when we have multiple jury trials or multiple even bench trials.
Butler says judges sometimes work out of conference rooms. People wait as cases get delayed. Attorneys' fees pile up.
It's a burden on everybody. It's more paperwork on our end. It's, you know, it's a hassle all the way around.
The county's growing population also demands more from law enforcement. And, perhaps ironically, that may ultimately help the courthouse. When the sheriff's department moves out of the bustling town center and into a new building, Butler says there's a chance the old jail could be converted for use by the court. Meanwhile, Adel itself has added a wing to the elementary school, and new housing is springing up to the south and east, stretching toward the interstate highways that lead to Des Moines, and, eventually, similar development explosions in the Missouri suburbs of Kansas City.
I'm Erica Hunzinger. 2 hours south in Clay County, 33,000 acres of farmland went away between 2007 and 2012, and the change is straining streets and schools. The morning buzzer lets students know classes are starting at Liberty High School, which is in a district that has grown by almost 5,000 students over the last 15 years. Chief Operating Officer Steve Anderson says many of those new students live in a residential and retail development area known as Shoal Creek Valley. It's part of Kansas City proper. When Shoal Creek's neighborhoods really started to take off,
I don't know if it caught the district off guard, but there was a point where there were a lot of trailers and just trying to kind of accommodate that more pressing need.
But now, he says, the school district has a handle on its population influx. And while they're still expecting to grow as the county does, the rate is going to slow down.
The balance act, obviously, is you want to build enough for the growth that's coming. You never want to overbuild. That would be irresponsible.
Some Shoal Creek kids go to school in the North Kansas City district. Spokeswoman Tammy Henderson said it's grown by the size of a grade school every year for the last 8 years. The district welcomes the growth. New school buildings and upgrades are in the works, and the buses that travel the 82-square-mile district now run on natural gas.
They're much more efficient when they run. So that's helped cut down on the amount of money that it takes to run our buses. Our buses run about, I'm going to say, 2 million miles a year.
And that brings us to what might be the most headache-inducing part of once rural areas sprouting thousands of homes, traffic. Consider a key state highway that runs east and west through Shoal Creek. It's already a four-lane road, but over a three-year period, there was a nearly 60% increase in accidents where it intersects with I-35. That part sees so much traffic that the Missouri Department of Transportation is planning to widen the bridge to 10 lanes. So it's ready for the next wave of people seeking a little space. With Amy Mayer, I'm Erica Hunzinger, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plains Safaris in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
Find more at harvestpublicmedia.org. Let's head into the kitchens of Farm Bloomington Restaurant with Chef Daniel Orr for a meal-sized salad recipe featuring some fresh spring sorrel.
We are going to do a chickpea salad with feta and sorrel. The sorrel is a great herb to grow. It's a big, leafy, spinachy-looking herb. It's a very lemony flavor. So we're going to drop those chickpeas in there. Now, these are canned chickpeas that have been drained and rinsed, but you could cook your own chickpeas if you wanted to. Next, we're going to add about 8 scallions. I'm not just going to cut the normal way where you just cut them into little rounds. I've cut them lengthwise, and then I'm going to cut them in about inch-long pieces. Then we're going to add a clove of minced garlic and the sorrel. Now, the sorrel I've cut into what we call in French chiffonade, which means kind of like a chiffon, kind of light and airy cut. I'm also going to add some other herbs. You could use any herbs you want: chervil, dill, mint, flatleaf parsley, cilantro, if you like. Now I'm going to kind of make a vinaigrette right in the bowl. And what I'm going to do is add the zest of about a half a lemon. Then, let's see, about 1 lemon's worth of lemon juice. Okay, we're going to add about 1/4 cup of extra virgin olive oil. Salt and pepper to taste. Now we're going to be putting some feta in this, and feta is quite salty, so be careful with your salt. I'm going to toss that. And the sorrel is going to give it that nice lemony flavor, and it's been, you know, enhanced with the lemon juice and lemon zest, so it's going to be very kind of a zesty salad. Now that I've got that all mixed up, I'm going to fold in the feta. I didn't want to add the feta before because I want it to keep kind of chunky. I don't want it to be totally emulsified into the salad. Then at the very end, I've got a little bit of that sorrel reserved that I'm going to sprinkle around the top. Again, you could add, if you wanted to add some cherry tomatoes or some julienne red peppers to it for color, you could do that. But I kind of like it like it is. And there it is. That is our chickpea, feta, and sorrel salad.
You know, you can find that recipe and so many others on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Today on Earth Eats, we're sharing a conversation from earlier in the year on the topic of food insecurity in the United States and some of the stories we tell ourselves as a culture about hunger. My guests today come to us from an organization called Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, also known as The Hub, in Bloomington, Indiana.
I am Amanda Nicky, the president and CEO of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
And I'm Stephanie Solomon, the director of education and outreach at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. We started as a food pantry with a focus on gardening and nutrition and healthy food. But when we moved in 2013 to our site at West Allen, we revisioned ourselves as a community food resource center. And what we mean by that is that we, yes, have a food pantry, and that is, in fact, our largest program, but it's housed within a resource center where not only can you come and access food assistance, but you can also learn about crockpot cooking or container gardening or borrow a crockpot or take a container home with you and borrow the tools that you need for your own garden, so that it's not just resources in terms of emergency food. It's resources in terms of what you need to build household food security. From the very beginning and by design, the Hub has been a food pantry that anyone can access in as dignified a way as possible, which is not always true when folks are looking to access services, social services around basic needs.
There's no means testing to use our services. People can come in. There's no really any forms to fill out or proof of identification or income level or need. We run on the honor system. People don't have to come in and jump through more hoops and prove their need in the ways that they might when they're accessing other resources. We trust that if people are coming in and getting food, then they need it. And it's not our place to judge whether they need it or how long they need it.
So I attended the Food Day event at the Hub this year and reported on it for Earth Eats, as you might remember. One of the components of the day involved addressing dominant narratives. And I was wondering, Stephanie, if you could start by talking about what you mean by a dominant narrative.
Dominant narratives are really the public narratives that surround us as we navigate the world. So there are narratives about larger issues of poverty, why some people have access to resources and why some people don't. And we've identified that there is a dominant narrative around hunger specifically, and that often it can perpetuate the very conditions of poverty and hunger. So Food Day gave us an opportunity to look at that public narrative and the ways that we as a community conceptualize hunger, why we think it exists, what the solutions are for it. And by tackling that narrative and really uncovering it, we can see where its truths and lies are and start to rebuild a narrative that's empowering and that truly addresses the roots of hunger and poverty.
So by narrative, dominant narratives, you're really talking about stories, the powerful stories coming from sort of the mainstream culture, the dominant culture, the culture with power. What are some of the stories that are surrounding food insecurity and hunger relief?
One of the narratives around hunger is that it's a temporary thing, that it's something that it's a condition that people experience, or it's situational. It's because of the loss of a job that is temporary, or something that someone is facing in terms of crisis with their health or some kind of family situation, and that the majority of people that experience hunger are able to move out of it, that, you know, using services like ours or other emergency food services is just something that people are going to do for a short amount of time.
And what follows from that is really, when we talk about stories, the bootstrap story. There is embedded in that story the idea that we have equal opportunity to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and truly make the need for a food pantry like ours a temporary occurrence. But we know that that is a flawed story because we see the circumstances that lead to all different needs for food assistance that are often long-term.
Yeah, I would add that, you know, the more attractive story that people want to hear is that it's a temporary need, that people come into the pantry, get some services for a couple of months, and then because of their ability to, you know, use our food pantry or our tool share or access to our education programming, then because of all of that coming together, then they are then able to kind of work their way out of that need, work their way out of poverty somehow. And I think that what's less attractive is that that's not the reality, really, for many of our patrons. Many of our patrons have been using emergency food services for years, and they will continue to use those services for years to come.
So it's not really emergency anymore. It's kind of a way of life.
It's one part of many resources in our community or beyond that people are using just to survive.
So why do you think that it's important to challenge these stories, and what kind of impact can that have?
I think what's most important in challenging these stories is that it helps us look at solutions from a different perspective. If we think that access to an emergency food pantry and the other kind of programming we have is that those things alone are going to solve hunger in our community, then we continue to put resources into those kinds of programs. We continue to support an emergency food pantry or education programs, you know, that kind of thing. But I think if we challenge those ideas and say we have to do more than just this programming, it just changes the way that we approach the problem. And I think that's where our advocacy work comes in that we recognize that just these kind of program things that we're doing alone are not going to solve these problems. We have to find ways for people to engage in their larger community, for people to get involved in legislation, for people to understand what's happening, the decisions that are being made about their lives and how they're going to impact them.
And we cannot advocate around food security with the single narrative and the single story that we have about people and poverty and hunger as it stands. And so part of our advocacy work is starting to lift up the real stories and the lived experiences of people who are needing food assistance, whether it's on a monthly or a longer term basis. So to ground why dominant narrative is an important topic, we have to look at the problematic stories surrounding hunger and how we can get the true stories out into the world.
So I wonder if you could give me an example of something that you might take on in your advocacy work or some way of changing or challenging that dominant narrative and replacing it with something else.
So we are launching in partnership with Hoosier Action, the Food and Farms Coalition, which is a campaign to focus on the 2018 reauthorization of the Farm Bill. And we have a group of small farmers, SNAP recipients, and pretty much those of us that eat food, which is all of us, who are going to be coming together to talk about how important the Farm Bill is. And with our Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly on the Agriculture Committee, we have a great opportunity to lift up some real stories of what people are experiencing. There are not very many stories about the experiences of Hoosiers who are attempting to farm and Hoosiers who have food stamps but not enough food stamps, or Hoosiers who qualify for food stamps but struggle to jump through all the hoops that they need to jump through to get access to them. And so this is a great example of where not only is it an advocacy campaign with a focus on improving the local and regional food system, but also on bringing out some of those stories that tend to be missing from the conversation.
Well, one of the things I heard one of you mention was something about addressing root causes to hunger. So what are some of those root causes that lead people to need to come to a place like Mother Hubbard's Cupboard to access food?
One that's really obvious that I guess we don't talk about very often is money. People don't not have food because there isn't food to be had. It's because they don't have money to buy it. It's really simplistic, but the solutions to that are really complex. And I think that that's why we don't talk about it. That's why we don't want to think about that when we think about food access or the number of people in our community who are food insecure, or that still 1 in 5 children in our community don't have access to adequate food on a daily basis. We don't want to think about the fact that it's just a lack of income that's making that happen, a lack of adequate income, because solving that problem is so much more complex than hosting a food drive.
If you're just joining us here on Earth Eats, my guests are Amanda Nicky and Stephanie Solomon with the Community Food Resource Center in Bloomington, Indiana. We've been talking about the dominant narrative surrounding hunger in America and what it means to focus on root causes of food insecurity.
So if we see hunger as an issue of inadequate food, then the best way to address it is obviously through food pantries and food banking and SNAP benefits. But if we look at root causes and we take hunger out of a vacuum and look at it through the lens of poverty and money, then our solutions change. And that's what we're trying to do by redefining the narrative.
And I would add that there's always the risk here of sounding like what we're saying is we shouldn't have food pantries, or we shouldn't have food banks, or emergency food programs shouldn't exist. And I want to say that that's not what we're saying. What we are saying is that it's not the sole responsibility of those organizations to solve the problem of hunger. It's impossible for those organizations to solve the problem of hunger. We don't have the power that the greater community has to draw attention to these issues, to provide solutions for these issues. But we're often tasked collectively as emergency food providers to solve this problem, to show how we're improving the lives of our patrons, to show how we're providing opportunities for growth. And I think we have to be honest and say that there's only so much we can do there.
The narrative that has been successful is that people need to eat now. And we should be proud of the work that our food banks and soup kitchens and food pantries do to address the fact that people need to eat now.
And I think it can be challenging to think on an individual level, kind of the decisions that we make or the ways that we live that perpetuate this problem for people in our community. And so when we, I don't know, it can be really uncomfortable to think more deeply about the decisions that you make on a daily basis that allow for economic inequities.
Like what?
Like development, wages in our community. I don't know. There's a lot of things that we choose to do as a community that it seems like we're not thinking about what's best for everyone. You know, a school putting on a food drive around the holidays is not in itself a bad thing. It's a very kind and thoughtful thing. But on a greater scale, it's not enough. And how often are we doing these small, seemingly caring and well-intentioned things that keep us from addressing the greater problems? And that's a really tricky place to be, because it's not that those actions in themselves are hurtful or unkind. They're the opposite. They're taking care of people in a moment when they need it. But in some ways, it's distracting us from the larger problems, and it's keeping us, it's keeping our hands busy with getting food out the door and the day-to-day challenge of just feeding people. And so we don't have, as an organization or as a community, we don't have the time and the resources to focus on those bigger problems.
So addressing some of those root causes, like living wages or affordable housing or the kind of things that might lift people out of poverty so that they don't need to go to a food pantry or don't need to apply for food stamps because they're have a sustainable life.
Right. I mean, we all want to be able to care for our families to the best of our ability and to not have to rely on services or government support. But we have to be honest and say that not everyone has that same opportunity. And that's a good place to start.
I've been speaking with Amanda Nicky and Stephanie Solomon from Mother Hubbard's Cupboard about the stories surrounding food insecurity. We could not manage to fit it all into one episode. The conversation continues in part two, which you can find archived on our website at eartheats.org. In part two, Solomon and Nicky discuss unicorn stories. You know, the ones about individuals rising up from difficult circumstances to lead successful lives. How those often inspirational stories can end up clouding our understanding and even masking the structural inequities that are built into our society. Again, you can find the second half of the conversation at eartheats.org. Support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services. Assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows. Helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. I want to thank everyone who makes Earth Eats possible, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Our executive producer is John Bailey.